Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island change procrastination in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which is all good for the economy, because now everybody can get a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. And my very special guest from GnosticMedia.com is the stunningly able and capable Jan Irvin. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Vinny. Thanks for having me back.
Okay. Now, first of all, proviso, during the last show, I think it was on Friday that we had about you, I actually told a lie. Well, a mistake, actually, because there was a little bit of a chronology mix-up there. However, I called Jan Irvin a liar, ladies and gentlemen, for saying that the previous guest, Tom Hatzis, didn't challenge him to a debate. I thought Jan was talking about before the interview, and Jan was talking about before the interview, and I thought he was talking about after the interview where he had, and so that was just a complete mistake on my part, and it's absolutely not true. Jan didn't lie. Just wanted to get that retraction there out of the way as quickly as possible. Whew. Now, it's been a I apologize for my state. I've had a pretty intense couple of weeks full of work. So, Jan, if you would lead off.
I get that. What, yeah. You need me to take over there?
Please do.
Like when I was on with Joe Atwill, when we just kind of took over the whole interview for you there for a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Well, you had the knowledge. I hadn't finished your article that you'd written.
Well, no, I think what happened was your line was dropped, and we just picked up the interview and just pretended like nothing happened, you know?
Like professionals do.
Right. Exactly. Well, you know what I was thinking? I think we only had like 12 or 15 or 20 minutes on Friday to even go over some of the stuff. So then, you know, what I was thinking was, you know, rather than rush through it all and just blah, like I was trying to do on Friday, what I'll do is I'll just go back through, you know, the key points and just touch on them one by one so that it's all cogent and coherent, et cetera. But, you know, starting off, Tom makes the false statement that, let's see.
Well, can I interject here, sure. Actually? Would you be able to elaborate? Because you said that there's a group of people, a group of characters out there who are always out trying to attack you and defame you. Could you enlighten the audience as to that paradigm? Sure.
I mean, you know, they kind of center around Simon Powell and Johnny Enoch, who this guy Tom Hatzis referenced last week, who was a friend of his who supposedly tried to attack me. But there's like, you know, they kind of, I guess, center around Reality Sandwich and this sort of group, but it's essentially a group that is propagandized to, well, the rest of the down folk are, but, you know, it's basically a group that's selling this agenda that we reveal in my recent article with Joe Atwill called Manufacturing the Deadhead, a Product of Social Engineering. And there's a lot of people that are victims of that, and a lot of people have bought into Terrence McKenna and the whole psychedelic movement as a religion, and they act like religious zealots. You know, and, you know, for instance, this guy, Johnny Enoch, he did a video, supposedly debunking my work in The Secret History of Magic Mushrooms, but he never even addressed a single thing that I actually wrote. You know, in fact, in the video, he says, quote unquote, citations are from Mars. So he had no interest in what I actually said or wrote. And, you know, his original attack on me was that, you know, when he first messaged me was that I had no right to talk about Terrence McKenna, a dead person, that he was 10 times the scholar as I, and how dare I criticize this guy? You know, we should, you know, if somebody's a criminal and we find out about it, we should put it out. It doesn't matter when we find out. We should put it out as soon as we find out, you know? So, you know, it's like either the second you realize that a fraud has been committed, you know, the second you realize that that's when the fraud was committed. You know, if you weren't aware of it before, you obviously can't bring it up. But whenever we discover something like that, we should put it out. I did get a kick out of your thing the other day on the trip up on the word philology. That was kind of funny. Well, you did finally get it right once or twice, so that was pretty good. But, You know, philology is actually the, it's the love of, you know, logos is essentially the word or, you know, the study of, and philo is love. So it's the, it's essentially the love of the word, right? So in other words,
philology is the study of the love of the word.
It's, well, no, it's actually, it's the study, philology is the study of words, essentially.
Uh-huh.
Their meanings, their origins, you know, taking it back through many different cultures. You know, John Allegro, he was a philologist. He was trained at Oxford, and he was one of the original eight philologists on the translation team of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Well, that makes a lot of sense.
Right. So
I find it interesting how a word that describes words and the study of words is so hard to pronounce.
Well, you know, you could always become an abecedarian.
I don't know what an abecedarian is. Is that some kind of
an abecedarian?
Like
is someone who studies an abecedarian is someone who studies their ABCs or studies the ABCs and the origins and all of that surrounding it. So it's abecedarian, abecedarian, right?
So it's not
and
a
so
dog. Like
actually,
it's not a dog like a Pomeranian.
No, it's actually where we get the word abracadabra from. Abracadabra. Right. Wow. So, and then of course, magic is all about spelling, and you know, the magi becomes the magistrate who writes the laws, et cetera. You know, these are direct links. And I did a show a few months back with Jose Barrera, and he exposed a lot of his new research on that area.
Now, over the weekend, did you get to spend much time with your boy, or did you spend it all trying to beef up?
Well, it was, you know, there was definitely a lot of time spent research, you know, preparing notes and things for the interview, but we did get some stuff done, and I did get him down to visit his grandmother for the afternoon on, what day was that, Friday or Saturday or something.
Let's see, we both got the kind of coughing thing at the moment.
Yeah, well, you know, and I've got cotton mouth too, so that's probably related to the cough.
Yeah, it could be. It could be.
Yeah.
Now, getting into this.
Got that. It was pun intended.
All right. So let's get into this sort of breaking down the Hatzis attack, because I think it's a microcosm of many attacks that are directed against you by a number of different individuals, sure. But they're all using the same tactics and saying more or less the same things, aren't they?
Well, and it's ironic because they're using the same tactics as they did against John Allegro in the first place, right? You know, but what we're dealing with here is all of these attacks going on. See, if my work is correct, especially on Gordon Wasson, then, and which is interesting that Tom Hatz has said he agreed with, and that was all original primary research that I did myself, and these are all documents that I acquired out of many different universities just on Gordon Wasson. This is also stuff out of the CIA archives, Hoover Institute, the CFR archives, etc.
For the listeners,
but it's interesting that he says that he
yeah, I'm holding up a massive box there, right. full of documents. Yeah.
Well, I just find it's funny that he says that he agrees with my research on Wasson, but that all of my research is crap, and that I don't know how to do research. But I'm the one who discovered all of the stuff on Wasson. Of course, none of these guys have ever asked me who attacked the work to actually see the documents. But here's the issue is if my work on Wasson is correct, then the entire field of ethnomycology and all of the scholars work within it for the last 55 years is impacted directly. And so, you know, many of them have come straight out and said, holy crap, you know, you're right. We got to put the brakes on this and reanalyze things. And others will say, well, you know, you've brought up some really good points, but I'm just not sure, but your conclusions might be wrong, and then they won't ever cite any of the things that don't add up, you know, and I'll ask them, you know, hey, let's sit down, let's go over the research, let's go over this, you know, box of documents here, and we can go over everything point by point and see what doesn't add up, and I've never had any one of these guys accept that offer, you know, but if Wasson's research is impacted, of course it's going to cause a lot of cognitive dissonance out there in the other researchers, you know, and especially people like Simon Powell and Daniel Pinchbeck and all of these guys that have, you know, Johnny Enoch, all of these guys that have themselves invested in this religion and are dedicated to it like zealots, regardless of where the information and citations take us. You know, and we need to be able to put our beliefs and our emotions aside and just look at the data, because you know what? I believe just like those guys did for years. And then going through, you know, when I was originally, it started in 2006, I was writing an article with Michael Hoffman about the debates over Wasson and Allegro and the Tree of Knowledge's Amanita muscaria. And so it was in the writing of that article when I was going through all of Allegro's entheogen citations. I literally checked out every single one in his whole book, and they all checked out. And that's when I started realizing that something was seriously wrong with the attacks on Allegro's work. And so it was around in 2007 when I was writing and putting together all of the notes that later became my book, The Holy Mushroom. It was in writing all of that when it occurred to me that there was no way that Wasson would just be putting out all of this disinfo and propaganda unless he was likely dirty in some way. And so it was around that time when I just started collecting notes, and anything that I found on Wasson that contradicted, you know, the official story of everything that went on, he and Valentina in the woods in New York. And for those who don't know, Wasson is the guy who supposedly discovered magic mushrooms. But what we found out was that, you know, and the story is that he's just a banker and, you know, just this guy, and he discovered it and everything. But we find out that he's actually working with the banking community. He's actually the vice president of propaganda for J.P. Morgan Bank, working with and trained by Edward Bernays, the father of propaganda. And we also, found documentation that he's involved with the CIA, with the Council on Foreign Relations, and with the Century Club, which is sort of the East Coast version of Bohemian Grove. And it was headed up by, you know, guys like Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA. We had Eisenhower there. In fact, I've got a whole list right here of people that were members there, and I can read you who were these guys that Wasson and was hanging out with while he's attacking Allegro and selling the mushroom story. But we've got Dwight Eisenhower, Dwight Morrow, Ellsworth Bunker, Frank Altschul, George F. Kennan, who is the ambassador to the Soviet Union, Henry Luce, who founded Time Life, is there. John Dewey, who created the current compulsory education system to dumb down the kids, he's there. John Foster Dulles, the former Secretary of State. Alan Dulles' brother, John Maynard Keynes, the economist. Gordon Wasson, Vannevar Bush, Walter Lippmann, who was another propagandist at the same time as Edward Bernays. And it goes on from there. But these are the people who Wasson was working with. And it was Wasson.
That's like the Dirty Dozen, you know.
Well, the dirty few hundred, I would say, but yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and they're all connected in. They connect, interestingly, directly into the Bohemian Club on the West Coast up here, in, you know, here in California, up in the Bay Area. And Wasson, Aldous Huxley was a member of the Century Club as well there with Wasson and Alan Dulles. And so Wasson and Aldous Huxley were working on all of this stuff. And as far as I can tell, Aldous Huxley was guy number one behind the foundation of MKUltra. Now, I've got a database on my website for listeners who want to check it out. On the front page of the website, go to GnosticMedia.com. You'll see a blue icon there, the brain database. You can download the full database or you can use the online version. And just, you know, we've got over 6,000-7,000 citations through there, and you need to read each one. If when you open it up and you see the connections there, don't just think, oh, it's guilt by association or whatever. You know, there's actually citations in there. And this just, you know, connects the dots between each person and player, but you need to go through and read the citations and read the instructions on the website, how the database works.
Could I interject? Aldous Huxley wrote the book Brave New World. Sure. Now, it's been said that George Orwell wrote 1984 not as a warning, but as a blueprint.
Well, sure. Well,
for how to win
Orwell,
people. Do you believe the same is true of Aldous?
Well, George Orwell was Aldous's student. Okay. See, Aldous Huxley, yeah, I mean, it's possible that George Orwell, Eric Blair turned, you know, and tried to expose it, but I'm in doubt. And there's, you know, later on letters between he and, in fact, that I published in August in another article, between he and Aldous talking about the ultimate revolution and how it's going to play out. Now, if you get into Aldous's book, Moksha, like on page 56, there's a write-up there from October 25, 1954, where he's talking about Dr. Andrea Puhrich's LSD experiments. And Andrea Puhrich was MK Ultra and U.S. Army intelligence out of Edgewood, Maryland arsenal. You know, and so, you know, here before any of the MK Ultra or anything, any knowledge of these studies is out, here's Aldous with this information, discussing it in his letters with other researchers. But, you know, when you read his book, Moksha, you go through it, and he sits there and he's warning about all of this stuff going on. And then in the next letter, you see him like at one of the universities there looking at all of the studies they're doing and then telling the doctor what studies need to be done next, et cetera. Right. So he's like, you know, but you have to realize that he's a Fabian socialist, and the Fabian socialist is the wolf in sheep's clothing.
Yeah, this is true. Or the turtle with the hammer, I believe, is another Fabian socialist symbol. Move slowly, but strike hard with the final blow. We'll be right back after the break with Jan Irvin from GnosticMedia.com. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week for your listening pleasure. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness and Bernaysian propaganda public relations, if you lose your sense of humor, you'll go friggin' nuts. And my very special guest is Jan Irvin. Welcome back.
Thank you.
I'm quite interested in the story that you were explaining about Aldous Huxley and the rise of this this MK Ultra movement.
Right. Well, you know, like I said before the break, Joe Atwill and I on May 13th we released a new article that covers a lot of this. And then let me pull it up here. You know, I forget the titles of my own articles and things sometimes. After you write something, it's hard to remember everything that you write. But the other one was...
Well, that's why you wrote it down, so you don't have to.
Exactly. You know, I've actually been attacked for not being able to remember all the titles of my books and stuff. You don't remember what you wrote? It was like 5 years ago, dude. So it's the other article, and it's under The Secret History of Magic Mushrooms, is how Darwin, Huxley, and the Esalen Institute launched the 2012 and psychedelic revolutions and began one of the largest mind control operations in history. And then, of course, you know, Sir Thomas Henry Huxley... Aldous Huxley and Julian Huxley's father was the propagandist for Darwin. And then Julian Huxley ran the British Eugenics Society and UNESCO, et cetera. And then they both basically take up all of their work, Aldous in the novels, and then Julian in his nonfiction books, go on to sell this agenda throughout their work.
Effect has this You're had muted. On society is actually had quite a lot of effect on society, hasn't it?
Because it's had a huge, yeah.
Lots of people were talking about 2012 in the lead up to it, and none of them have come out since and recused themselves and say, you know what, I was just a mind controlled idiot and I didn't know what the heck I was talking about.
Or even worse, they're part of the agenda, unlike Reality Sandwich right now with a Kickstarter video requesting more money so that they can come out with Reality Sandwich version 2.0, because obviously 1.0 went in the shitter.
We can't say that on FCC regulated radio. I apologize.
Excuse me, on the crutter.
Beep.
That was my bad, folks. I apologize.
It happens. Right, and I don't know what it is about this show that makes my guests feel comfortable enough to cuss, but it happens.
Well, when I was on your old show, it was everything was, everything was okay.
I think that might have been when we were recording off air, yeah. Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, when you're using language and all of that kind of stuff, there's certain things that are offensive and make people aggressive and so on and so forth. Okay, so you've been accused of being like what a liar, a fraud, and all these other things. And what I found interesting about the dynamic is one person can say one thing as an accusation with zero evidence attached to it, and in order to actually fully debunk and prove unequivocally that person's lying, it takes an inordinate quantity of citations and research and things of that nature, which you've actually put out since that previous interview.
Well, not only that, but I had already actually written a whole debunking of his article on February 16, and I had sent it to him, and then, of course, he omitted all of it in, you know, his radio interview with you and claimed that I never responded to him, et cetera. You know, and you know what? One thing that he actually said that I addressed all of the philology in my work. I never said that. What I said is that we addressed all of the entheogen stuff in my work. So, and he actually even paused and then asked you if that was what I said, because he, you know, he wasn't even quoting me or citing me. He was just thinking of things that might be right and then saying them as fact and then attacking me for things that I never said. But, you know, it's like he constantly cited Karl Ruck, right? Well, Karl Ruck actually did address all of Allegra's philology issues. And right here in the second 40th anniversary edition of John Allegra's book, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, right in the very back, and I published this book, but right in the very back here is an article titled Fungus Redivivus by Karl A.P. Ruck. Now, I published that article. So, of course, he omits all of the philology that we did already address. I'm not a philologist. I had a philologist address the work. Now, you know, and we also had another philologist, Anna Partington, and I read her quote last week, and her quote was in both books. My book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, as well as my book, The Holy Mushroom, and of course, he omitted that as well. And, you know, he said that I went to Cal State Northridge specifically to get all the quotes on this. Actually, that was most of the research that we did at Cal State Northridge for those 3 days was specifically on astrotheology. It was for one research topic. I already showed you a big box down here of stuff I have. You know, what he's doing is he's conflating topics and issues and discussions and then merging them into one and then going, ha, 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 you know, so that he can look, you know, clever and intelligent. But, you know, that wasn't the only time. That was specifically about astrotheology. And we did also go through and pull up, you know, maybe a dozen or half a dozen academic articles that Allegra had published on the Dead Sea Scrolls that weren't really related to the research, but we wanted to have them archived, and we put those up on the John Allegra website. So, you know, he's confusing and conflating many ideas, and he apparently doesn't even know, you know, the premise of my book. He didn't read it all the way through and get what the arguments were or anything. He just kind of cherry-picked, or maybe he used, you know, like Amazon online search to go through the book. Like, you know, for instance, there was an image that I caught him attacking towards the back of the book, and all of his attacks were about the back of the book. He didn't address any of the primary documentation. The entire front of the book is all primary documentation, all original research that we did. He didn't address any of it.
He skipped right to the back of the book. 115.
He skipped straight forward to page 115, and then he attacked, you know, this image talking about how it's blue, you know, this image here, if for those who can see it on the camera, and how it's blue. But he omits that this whole section here is about both psilocybe and amanita mushrooms. And right here, just four pages before that, we even have the different growth cycles of both mushrooms listed there. But we talk throughout this section about how the mushrooms were often amalgamated and even with trees and other plants to hide, you know, what they were. You know, it's not much of a mystery religion if you just put it right out there and make it as plain as day for everybody to get. But, you know, this image of the salamander, and what, you know, he attacks me because I had pulled this, and myself and others had pulled this from Chris Bennett, and he thought that it was an alchemical text when it was actually a Christian bestiary. But one thing that Tom Hatzis doesn't get, and I still haven't had the time to check if it was a Christian bestiary, but if he's correct, that's actually more support for our work. And you can see on there that this is very similar to the Adam and Eve story, and many of the Adam and Eve pictures even have a lizard more than a snake in the depictions there. And you know, he says that
what does the word bestiary mean?
It's a book of beasts and mythological creatures and things like that, right? And so what he says, you know, Tom Hatzis must think that this story is literal, because, you know, he argues that salamanders can't burn, and that, you know, the poison from the salamander entered the tree, and that the guy is eating poison fruit. He doesn't make the connection that poison and drugs were basically considered the same back then. In ancient Greece, and I interviewed Dr. David Hillman on my show about this a couple of years ago, but in ancient Greece, the only difference between, you know, between the drug and a poison was dosage. Like, it was common for people to get high on things like hemlock, which is you know, of course, a poison, and just you increase the dosage a little bit and it kills you. But at a low dose, it has an intoxicating effect. So, but he actually apparently thinks that the salamander literally doesn't die in a fire. And I guarantee you, if you take a salamander and you put it in a fire, it's going to die. You know, and so he thinks that the magical poison, he takes this all as literal instead of allegory. You know, and so here we have the salamander on this side climbing up the tree. And right here, from an ancient Italian text, we have the serpent climbing up what looks very much like a psilocybe mushroom. You know, so these are very similar themes here. And here's another one right here. And this is the plain coral fresco from France. And it's almost the identical theme. So what he's doing is he's not taking the theme as a whole. And like I said, if it's a Christian bestiary, then it's even more support for our work. And there's another one right there with the mushroom trees and everything. And there's even, in this one, in the cap of that mushroom, there are even smaller mushrooms. Now, there was one image here that he attacked. He did attack two images, I did check. And, you know, what he's not understanding is that all of this stuff is allegory. Now, he attacks on page 137, the Last Judgment from the Holcomb Bible, which is 1320 to 1330. And it says, you know, and I could have been a little more clear on this, and he is right in some aspect, which I'll clarify here. I could have put more of this information in the book on this section, but the wounded Christ sits flanked by two angels with the instruments of the passion. The angel on the left stares at three distinct mushrooms that he holds in his hands. Okay, so here's this image right here, and you can see this whole thing going on here. Now, I've already shown several of the Adam and Eve mushroom trees. And the, you know, we have this constant mushroom allegory. Like, look at this one. This one's from Russia, and we can actually see them sitting around a table with Amanita spotted, like, chalices sitting there on the table, you know, with a bowl being sacrificed down in the front, Mithra style. So, you know, all of these other symbols are omitted, and then what he does is he nitpicks this one thing. But if we get into the let me just find that real quick. If we get into the passion, and let me just pull up my citations on that here real quick.
Also, just remember that because we're on radio, the audience can't see these images. So okay. Give a brief description as you're showing them.
Okay, right, okay. Well, and maybe we can include some of the images there. But, you know, it's basically, it's a picture that looks very much like Archangel, and I think it was Michael I just read, holding up three mushrooms. Now, he attacks me for this, and he says, these are the instruments of the passion. Now, let's go back and let's look at what are the instruments of the passion. Now, in my book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, we covered most of these symbols. Now, what we have is the chalice, which I just showed you, a red and white spotted one that looks like the mushroom. The hammer, Thor's hammer, related to lightning. This is very often, by very many mythologists, been related to psychedelic experience. The ladder, climbing to the heavens. The serpent enwrapped tree that is also the caduceus, the symbol of drugs. The cross and spear, the cross has been argued as that as well. The spear, in some instances, has both the sun and moon, as we show in this book, have, and this is my book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, both the sun and moon have been argued as the mushroom for the different growth stages, and this can be read in Ruck's book, which he says he supports, in Allegro's work, etc. You know, but it's interesting that he, you know, attacks Allegro and then says he's for Ruck. You know, when Ruck has wrote extensive work showing a lot of Allegro's work is in fact correct. But we also have a vassal. Oh, here's a good one: the purple robe or the scarlet robe, right? Well, what, you know, if we look at the top of a bright red and white spotted Amanita muscaria, you know, we have this same sort of color and theme going on here. And then we have a vassal, the pincers to remove the nails, which I think is an interesting comment. Maybe, you know, in my interpretation, that would probably be something for removing the mushrooms and things like this. Like in Europe, when they would pick things like, mandrake, they would actually tie a dog around the plant and then have the dog drag it out so that the mythical shrieks from the plant wouldn't kill anyone in ear sight. Lanterns and torches we covered in Astrotheology and Shamanism related to mushrooms. Swords, we covered that related to mushrooms. You know, and in your interview with him, he claimed to have read my book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, but how did he skip over all of these key points that are the instruments of the passion that we covered in this book? You know, and when I look at all of the images of the nails and other things, I mean, they look so distinctly like psilocybe-type mushrooms. And when you look at all of the other instruments of the Passion, you know, and we, you know, if we take these stories literal, we're gonna miss the point. If we take these as ancient mystery initiations and drug cults and things, which there's a lot of evidence that there is, then what we're arguing makes sense. But if you take things out of context and misconstrue them and what we're presenting, then, you know, you can make up a hokey argument to attack all of our work. But, you know, he goes on, he attacks, you know, the word liberal, and the word liberal meaning, you know, coming from the word ever to be free, and says, you know, if I knew Latin, I would have take that all the way back. Well, we're talking about, you know, the first primary origin of the word liberal in English to the, you know, primary Latin, which is free, and it goes back to book. So where do books come from? He attacks me for not going back to bark. It's like saying, you know, you're not going back to the word, you know, to papyrus when you talk about the word paper. Bark is where we get paper, is where books are made from. You know, that was the whole argument, was we're talking about the books were in the libraries. And just because, you know, the ancients, you know, wrote things down that they made from bark on paper, papyrus, etc., you know, it doesn't negate the point. So, you know, he's creating a false argument. But interestingly, some of the barks that were used, the inner barks of plants, wood usually containing a large portion of woody fibrous cells, including, especially as that of hemp, etc. So I found that citation quite interesting there. But, you know, there's just so many dozens of these little things that he attacked me for. He attacks me for pronouncing the word trivium in English, which we talked about on Friday, and anybody can look this up in any dictionary. It is pronounced trivium in English. We're not sitting here speaking in Latin, so we don't have any need to say every single word that we're using in Latin. So it is trivium in English. Anyone can look that up. There's no reason to create a ridiculous attack about that. He goes on in his attack against me to talk about Dr. Robert Price. He claims that, well, hold off.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that.
That's the same spot as last time.
Yeah. All right. In the end, everything comes back to the beginning. And we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Hopefully it won't take 1,000 years where fact turns into legend and legend turns into myth. Back in a minute.
Been edible. I'm a cracker, not a vegetable, fed to an extraterrestrial. The beat is so electrical, it'll pump your heart ventricles, but I bet you will eject it if I start getting intellectual. I am not yet credible, so until I can say I'm credible, I'll
welcome
say that
back,
I'm incredible, respectable, and professional.
Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the show that's all about being an edible extraterrestrial, right here on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, broadcasting live from terrestrial radio stations around the world. Do not try to eat them, okay? The people who work at these stations work very hard, and they are not edible terrestrial radio. Now, we were doing over the break, you know, I thought it'd be funny. I like to laugh at the New World Order's jokes. You know how they play jokes on us and stuff like that, and they sit back like, jet fuel, that's a good one. In the case of 9/11. And I was just thinking, you know, how we've got all these boy bands and they're like brainwashing all the kids and getting all the girls like clustered around and stuff like that, like Boys to Men or Westlife or whatever. And, you know, I was just thinking I should start a boy band, you know, facts to myth. And I reckon that'd be great. You know, you could be up in front of the stage with all these prepubescent girls brainwashing them. And they're as they're all chanting, facts to myth, facts to myth. I'm not planning on seriously doing this, of course, but I have the philosophy that if an evil scumbag is making you the butt of the joke, I think if you laugh too, then you rob them of their power over that joke.
Mm-hmm.
I could be wrong. Jan Irvin's my very special guest. Welcome back.
Thanks.
If you would continue your point that you
sure,
were
well,
getting
you know,
onto after the...
It's pretty funny because twice now, right when we got to discussing Robert Price, the commercial music started up, right? So, you know, this time we'll get into it right at the beginning here. But, you know, he attacks me for citing Robert Price in there. Robert Price, it actually pulled his negative review of Acharya S.'s first book, The Christ Conspiracy. Apparently, Tom Hatzis didn't know that Acharya and Dr. Robert Price had worked together for a time. But, you know, in Robert Price's last review of her most recent book, and she's got five on all of this, and, you know, people that attack the first book, they forget that she's got four others that, you know, you have to take all the research as a whole on this. And, in fact, I supplied some of the original primary citations to, like, Church Father Epiphanius that supports all of that. But here's a quote from Robert Price. He says, "I find myself in full agreement with Acharya S. D.M. Murdoch. We assert that Christianity constitutes Gnosticism, historicized and Judaized, likewise representing a synthesis of Egyptian, Jewish, and Greek religion and mythology, amongst others, including Buddhism, via King Asoka's missionaries from around the known world. Christianity is largely the product of Egyptian religion being Judaized and historicized." Robert Price. So does that sound like he's totally against everything that she's ever written that, you know, Tom Hatzis tried to, you know, portray the other day, misrepresenting Robert Price and slandering all of that? So, you know, and another interesting thing, I'm not sure if Tom was discussing my book, The Holy Mushroom, or my book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, but what he says in there in his interview with you is that my book had five references in the bibliography. So just so you can see this, here's page one of the bibliography, page two, page three, page four, and page five. It's actually 71 references there. So that's a whole lot more than five. I don't know why he needs to lie about that. But if he was talking about my book, A&S, the bibliography there actually has 300 citations, or almost 300. And then it's got, 500 and something footnotes in it as well. So, you know, 300, how does he confuse 300 with 5? How does he confuse 500 and some odd citations with 5? And many, many dozens of those are to primary citations like the Church Father Epiphanius text that I mentioned just a minute ago. So, I mean, you know, did he represent anything accurately? What is his agenda? Is he, you know, is he working with Johnny Enoch and these guys just to go pump out stuff? Is he a scion? You know, what the heck is going on there? I don't know. But he has no interest in being honest. He has no interest in admitting that I rebutted him back in February, you know, wasting all this time with this, you know, with this nonsense and all this hoopla that he wants to create. Usually I wouldn't even address this kind of stuff. You know, and it's funny, is up on your Skype thing earlier today, you had some, you know, a quote that was kind of pertinent to that too. I should have grabbed it. But you know, so he's always, his whole attack about the salamander and, you know, how bad a researcher I am, you know, back in the 2006, 2007, 2008, you know, you couldn't just upload an image and search the whole internet and figure out where the image came from, etc. Like Chris Bennett had found that image. We had actually spent a long time tracking it down, so I'm glad that he found that it's a Christian bestiary text, because it gives us much more support for the work. But let me see. I mean, you know, he goes on about, he talks about he claims all Latin, all of the alchemy stuff out there is in Latin, that none of it's been translated into English, you know, and then he, all of a sudden, he switches to quote unquote, well, not this one, I translated it. Okay, so, you know, he goes from all, I couldn't have studied any of this stuff, to this one text because he translated it. Again, you know, changing the point, but he does appeal to popularity about how many academics agree or disagree, regardless of whether or not they've studied the work and the details of the research. If their own agendas are involved in the research, such as me exposing Wasson and all of these scholars who have their last 55 years of their life invested in Wasson and him being a real guy when it turns out that he wasn't, right? So,
yeah, well, I found it very interesting is that kind of appeal to popularity is really rampant throughout society. Even last night on Facebook, I had somebody comment on my status saying, oh, your number of friends has gone down on Facebook lately, therefore you don't have any credibility at all.
Right,
and then I replied to him and said, well, you know, you're absolutely right, because one's credibility is only determined by how much friends they have, right?
On Facebook.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, you know, that's like Tom Hatzis and these guys. They don't focus on each point of the research. Instead, they cherry pick two things out of an entire book and then nitpick on these two things. You know, so, I mean, it's just ridiculous. Why ignore all of the primary evidence and documentation that debunked all of his claims, in fact, regarding Allegro and all of the statements against him and his work? Why ignore all of that and then just focus on these two images, excuse me, unless he's got an agenda there, you know, or just completely, you know, out of his mind? I don't know what's the case. I'm not trying to name call or attack the guy or call him a coward or anything, but I mean, you know, there's definitely some cognitive dissonance in there and some serious lack of critical thinking.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, because when you and I've experienced this myself, maybe you have too, when somebody's kind of coming up with an idea that you inherently disagree with or whatever, even if you're wrong, you start to come up and try and find anything you can, any tiny little thing, even no matter how wrong it is, in order to throw it at you and just go, like,
throw the spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks.
Yeah.
Right. See, you know, and they just literally, they will throw everything at you. They will never go point by point through the research, which I would love. And then what they'll do is they'll criticize you for not taking their feedback about your work that they never read. And they're like, you know, you won't take other people's feedback and points. You're not open-minded. You're an a-hole. You're this and you're that. And it's like, well, you know, if you would actually read my work first before you gave me all of these unfounded opinions that aren't about anything that I wrote, then maybe we could sit down and have an intelligent conversation about it. But you're making up lies and wild assumptions out of pure ignorance about things that I never said or wrote or claimed or anything. And then they attack me for not listening to their nonsense that they, you know, channeled from your anus.
That's happened a couple of times again on Facebook, where people will come on and say you're a moron and F you and just abuse, and then you block them, and then you see them going on and complaining on different forums how Vinny Eastwood doesn't care about free speech because I blocked them for giving me nothing but abuse and tirades.
Right. Exactly. You know, and going back to his attack on me on philology, and I read this last week regarding Anna Partington. I just want to read it again so people can hear this. But his whole attack on philology, missing that Carl Ruck and I together published a 15-page addendum, all philology, in the back of the Sacred Mushroom of the Cross, 40th Anniversary Edition, that was published in 2009. I don't know how he missed that, but it is from Professor Ruck. And then Anna Partington, who is a well-known Sumerian expert, says, this is from ANS, and my intro leading into her quote, since the time Allegro published The Sacred Mushroom of the Cross, much new research in the area of fertility cults and their relationship to entheogens, and especially mushrooms, has surfaced. Finding a Sumerian philologist who possesses a knowledge of entheogens and fertility cults is next to impossible. However, during our research, we learned of one highly credited Sumerian philologist, Anna Partington. Partington is a former associate of Allegro, who also possesses a deep understanding of entheogens and fertility cults. Though not in complete support of his views, this is what she had to say regarding Allegro. Quote, most people come to the field of Sumerian studies with a background in several early Eastern Mideastern languages. Although John was of a previous generation, he was, in common with most Orientalists, perfectly well equipped. And, you know, when they say Orientalists, basically anything that's east of Greece is considered the Orient. So I've actually had people attack me, well, Allegro was an Orient. He wasn't qualified to study Hebrew and all of this stuff. But that, you know, the Orient includes anything east of Greece. So we got to be clear on that. Let's see. Orientalists perfectly well equipped to deal with cuneiform languages. He found comparative linguistic study especially interesting. But early in his career, the finding of the scrolls by the Dead Sea led him to specialize in the translation of these Hebrew and Aramaic documents. She goes on anyway. We'll finish the rest of the quote when we get back.
Yeah, and also when we get back, there's a number of criticisms of me based on that interview that I would actually like you to go into and pull me up on after the break, because I think it's like basically I want to really just be honest and say that I messed up, you know, with that thing, didn't do my the grammar and during the interview didn't apply the trivium as it should have done, and so on and so forth. We want to actually go in those details and learn a little bit about how kind of lazy and unthinking I can be sometimes. We'll be right back, sure, ladies and gentlemen, at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com.
Imminent pollution, gathering dust particles, funneling through smokestacks, airwaves, bandwidth, disinformation too fed. Check the labels, delete the virus, alert the masses.